Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and in the early hours of Friday, the 24th of July, these are the main stories. Democratic congresswomen have been denouncing sexism in US politics after their youngest member says she was verbally abused by a Republican on the Capitol steps. The United States has accused Russia of test-firing an anti-satellite weapon in space. A group of Italian police officers have been arrested and their station closed over allegations of drug dealing, extortion and torture. Also in this podcast...
From the air, it looked like the aftermath of a massacre. Elephants, hundreds of them, dead or dying in a remote corner of Botswana.
Meeting the conservationists who have become detectives in an effort to find out why hundreds of elephants have died mysteriously in this region of Africa. A bitter partisan divide within American politics was underlined again on Thursday when Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez accused a Republican congressman of using abusive language at her on the steps of the U.S. Capitol building. Ms. Ocasio-Cortez said Ted Yoho's verbal insults had been part of a pattern of demeaning language towards women.
Not only have I been spoken to disrespectfully, particularly by members of the Republican Party and elected officials in the Republican Party, not just here, but the President of the United States last year told me to go home to another country with the implication that I don't even belong in America. The Governor of Florida, Governor DeSantis, before I even was sworn in, called me a whatever that is. Dehumanizing language is not new.
I spoke to our correspondent, Neda Taufik, and asked her to tell us more about what Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez had to say.
Really, Representative Ocasio-Cortez has really said that Representative Ted Yoho was lying when he described their interaction as a conversation. She says it was a verbal assault. I mean, here you had this representative approaching her at the Capitol building, calling her dangerous, calling her, that expletive, that very rude language. And when she confronted him and told him that his language was rude, you know, he didn't really respond in a way that she thought was really showing remorse. And she says the big picture here is that there is a lack of impunity. There is a culture of misogyny that has been prevalent across this country and particularly in Washington against congresswomen. And she's saying that there's an entire structure that accepts that. And so while she says she wasn't particularly offended personally by what he said because she's used to these types of attacks, she felt for other victims of abuse she had to speak out. And so she really used this moment on the House floor to call out this misogynistic culture, as she described it.
And it highlights once again, if ever we needed another reminder, that US politics is very vicious, very rancorous, very polarized, and it's an election year.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen the rhetoric around the election when it comes to policing, because, you know, this issue once again goes back to the issue of defunding police and social justice. This is what the Representative Ted Yoho was, you know, upset with Representative Ocasio-Cortez about. He said that her equating poverty to the rise in crime was a dangerous assertion. Now, she's used to conservative attacks, but what we're seeing here is that this is getting deeply personal. I mean, his attack on her on the Capitol building steps was a personal confrontation. It wasn't just a debate about politics. And that's what I think the key issue here is, that ahead of the election, the partisan divides are becoming even more toxic than before.
Now, let's stay with American politics. Donald Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, he's been allowed out of jail to write his book, which I suspect won't be complimentary about the president.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, we already heard from Michael Cohen's lawyers that this book will paint President Trump as a racist, someone who made racist comments about Nelson Mandela, President Obama, also anti-Semitic slurs that were used by the president. And what was really interesting in this court hearing was that the judge completely agreed with Michael Cohen's lawyers that he was taken from home confinement back to prison as a form of retaliation to stop him from exercising his First Amendment rights and publishing this book and speaking on social media about the president ahead of an election year. He said the timing wasn't coincidental, that right when the New York Post put out an article saying that a book would be coming out by Mr. Cohen, that the Bureau of Prisons decided to all of a sudden issue certain conditions, including that he cannot write or talk to the press. He said that this for the judge was a clear issue of retaliation and that he had to be released following a coronavirus test.
Neda Tofik in the United States. A new U.S. Space Command says Russia last week conducted a test firing of an anti-satellite weapon in space. The force commander, General Jay Redmond, said that this was further evidence of Russia's continuing efforts to develop and test space-based systems. Jonathan Beale reports.
The US, China, India and Russia have all developed anti-satellite missile technology, though so far these have mostly involved test firing from the ground into space. Russia, though, has now been accused of going further by conducting a test firing from one of its own satellites. The incident will heighten concerns of a new arms race in space. Other nations, too, are investigating technologies that could be used as weapons in space, but the US State Department has accused Moscow of hypocrisy by publicly arguing for arms control while having no intention of halting its own space weapons program.
Jonathan Beale. The number of coronavirus cases recorded in the United States has passed 4 million. The tally kept by Johns Hopkins University also shows more than 144,000 deaths. The US has the world's highest number of infections. On Thursday, President Trump announced he was cancelling the Republican Party's main convention in Florida, due to take place at the end of next month, because of the high number of cases of the virus in that state. Our correspondent David Willis is in Los Angeles.
The president, having focused for the best part of a month now, maybe longer than that, on reopening the American economy, has had to confront the effect that the coronavirus is having on this country because of the growing figures here and the number of cases, which, of course, today topped more than 4 million. Well, now it's come even closer to home because one of the epicenters of the coronavirus is Florida, and there have been plans to move the Republican National Convention to Jacksonville after the Charlotte, North Carolina Mayor Roy Cooper objected to certain plans for people to gather in large groups there. And now that is being postponed, as the president announced. It's going to be some sort of virtual acceptance of his party's nomination. And that is really thwarting all the intentions, both of President Trump and his supporters, to have some sort of big gathering where he could address a full arena and accept his party's nomination for president. So an indication of just how close to home all this is striking.
David Willis. The outgoing Director General of the World Trade Organization, Roberto Azevedo, has warned that the agency may not survive if it didn't evolve. Andrew Walker reports.
It is a challenging time for the WTO. The pandemic has made global trade more difficult. President Trump's administration has reservations about the organisation, which has been put under further strain by the disputes between the US and China. Roberto Azevedo told the member countries that the rules they had agreed were still relevant and much needed. They were, he said, the last bastion preserving some degree of order and predictability in global trade and economic relations. He said they were fundamental pillars of peace and prosperity, and they could be lost.
Our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker. Millions of people have been displaced in South Asia from severe floods caused by torrential monsoon rain. More than 300 people have been killed by the floods so far across India, Bangladesh and Nepal. But forecasters are warning that there could be more rain in some parts in the region, which is already battling COVID-19. This man in India's northeastern state of Assam, one of the areas most affected by the flood, described the situation there.
The situation is very bad here. Everything has been damaged. Our houses have been ruined. The cattle are dying and we are facing difficulty getting food.
Our South Asia regional editor is Ambarasan Etharajan.
Though monsoon rains are an annual event in South Asia, this year it has been particularly bad. And as you know, most of the rivers, they originate high in the Himalayan mountains, some in the Tibet region, some in the Nepal, and they pass through India, Then they go via Bangladesh before merging into the Bay of Bengal. The mighty Brahmaputra River has been flowing above the danger mark for the past 1 month because of this torrential monsoon rains, and there has been no respite for the people. And the weather forecasters say the rain has been at least 20% more than the average, and it has been continuous, which means not giving any chance for the people to recover. And for example, in Nepal, the landslides have killed dozens of people. More than 140 people have died in the past few weeks alone because these flash floods causing landslides. And in India, it is more of floods, you know, going into these rural areas, inundating millions of hectares, uprooting millions of people. Now, tens of thousands of people have been moved to the shelter. And in Bangladesh, the authorities describe this as the worst flood in more than a decade. Even though Bangladesh witnesses floods very often, they have not seen this kind of waterlogging because the rains have been continuous. So it has killed hundreds of people in the region, causing widespread death and destruction this year.
And amid all of this, the worst pandemic in many decades.
That's a challenge for the authorities because tens of thousands of people have been moved to these shelters, both in India and in Bangladesh. First of all, people do not want to leave their belongings. People are living with the very basic things, you know, in tin roof houses with a very few belongings and cattle. And they're worried that somebody might steal them if they leave and go and live in the shelter areas. And in the shelters, you see hundreds of people huddled together. And only if you go to shelter, you're going to get some food and other essential for your survival. And in these shelters, it is impossible to maintain social distancing, even though the authorities have been like asking people to cover your mouth with a piece of cloth, even if you don't have any face masks. That is another challenge because Assam is also seeing a rapid increase in the number of COVID-19 cases.
Ambarasan Etharajan. Now to Botswana. And you may remember that earlier this year, hundreds of wild elephants, 356 by one count, died suddenly en masse. Was it an accident or an animal massacre? Tests sent to foreign laboratories are starting to give some preliminary answers, as our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding reports.
From the air, it looked like the aftermath of a massacre. Elephants, hundreds of them, dead or dying in a remote corner of Botswana.
Elephants were dropping dead, in some cases literally in their tracks, falling forward and dying. Others wandering around in circles in clearly a state of distress.
But why? There was no drought in the region. The elephants hadn't suddenly starved en masse.
It's a mystery.
Dr. Keith Lindsay has been studying African elephants for 40 years. Now he's playing detective. An early theory, some sort of natural poison.
In some cases, there are bacteria, blue-green algae, that contain cyanide, cyanobacteria, and those have been seen to kill some animals in water holes.
Except only elephants were killed, no other animals. Not what you'd expect if it was a poisoned water hole.
So it has to be something specific and targeting the elephant in this situation.
Here's another sleuthing wildlife expert, Dr. Lingisisi Babayani from the Okavango Research Centre in Botswana. He's wondering if it might be a virus, even a relative of COVID-19, in which case
it can also go into other species, it can affect people, stuff like that. I think those warrant urgency in knowing what it is.
Urgency indeed. But what about the most obvious suspect of them all? Poaching. Botswana's huge and growing elephant population is a tempting target for poachers. So maybe this was a case of deliberate poisoning by humans, except for one tusk-shaped piece of evidence.
A lot of the carcasses which were found were more or less intact.
You mean with their tusks? Yes.
The tusks were in there.
So not poaching, unless...
Unless it's an operation which went horribly wrong for the poachers.
And it's at this point that the mystery takes another turn, a political one.
Shoot! Shoot!
Botswana's government recently and controversially started allowing limited elephant trophy hunting. This is a video of a recent kill.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Some wildlife researchers are now wondering whether this might explain why the authorities have been a little slow to investigate the case of the 300-plus dead elephants.
There was a gap between the discovery of it and reporting, and then a lot of precious time was lost. A lot of time was lost.
Dr. Lindsay smells at least a partial cover-up.
I think it is quite likely that they don't want their international reputation tarnished by reports of elephants dying like this. So the initial reaction is to kind of keep it quiet for as long as possible.
Botswana's National Parks Service insists there is no conspiracy, pointing out that any investigation during a global pandemic is going to be slow. And besides, they are now making progress.
We are starting to get some of the results back now.
Director Cyril Taolo told me the first tests, just back from foreign laboratories, seem to rule out a deadly virus.
It is not something that would normally spread, infectious bacteria or virus. We are looking at potential causes that could be linked to something that the elephants have consumed in the process of drinking water.
So maybe, but still only maybe, it was a natural poison, something that only kills elephants, something that wiped out dozens of close-knit families as they stumbled and fell in the Botswanan bush.
That report by Andrew Harding. Still to come in this podcast...
The Royal Presentation cigarette case, are we all done? At £61,000.
A cigarette case given to a speech therapist by the late British King George VI has sold for almost $100,000 in an auction in southern England. Now to a case that's been front page news across Italy. Prosecutors say they have shut down a criminal gang run by the police. Operating from a station in the northern Italian city of Piacenza, a group of Carabinieri police officers has been arrested, accused of drug dealing, extortion and even torture. Announcing the arrest of the four officers, the Piacenza prosecutor Grazia Pradella said the officers had taken advantage of the COVID-19 outbreak.
I want to remind you that we are in an area severely affected by COVID, that all the most serious alleged offences were committed in the time of COVID, in lockdown, and with contempt for the most basic restrictions imposed by the presidency of the council through the various decrees that were gradually issued.
Our Rome correspondent Mark Lowen began by telling me about the alleged crimes.
They are, a group of them are accused in the northern city of Piacenza of effectively running a kind of criminal cell within the Carabinieri barracks in Piacenza. And they are accused of a number of different crimes of drug dealing, embezzlement, torture, extortion, receiving stolen property. They're accused of supplying drugs to dealers at the height of Italy's coronavirus lockdown and holding kind of champagne-fueled parties, and crimes that date back to 2017. Now, there was another member of the Carabinieri that reported them to a higher judicial authority here. There were phone taps, and now 12 people at that police station are under investigation. Five members of the Carabinieri are currently detained, and another is under house arrest.
What is shocking Italy appears to be the fact that so many millions of Italians were locked in their homes during lockdown, and these guys were paying drug dealers to travel around selling their produce.
Yeah, selling marijuana and cocaine. And when you read the transcripts of the phone calls that they had with drug dealers, or indeed the torture and assault that they inflicted upon members of sort of people who were brought in who were found to have drugs on them, and then the Carabinieri kind of abused them and assaulted them in order to uncover the biggest stash of marijuana and cocaine, which they then took and supplied to others. It really is kind of classic mafioso criminal behaviour. And this was all happening in Piacenza, which is a city in Emilia-Romagna, which is a region in kind of northern Italy, which was very badly hit by coronavirus. It was the region with the third highest number of coronavirus cases. So while the rest of the region was in complete lockdown, this organized criminal cell within the Carabinieri in the city were making hay while the sun shine.
Mark Lowen in Rome. China says it may withdraw the legal recognition of British national overseas passports used by many Hong Kong residents. The foreign ministry said actions by the UK meant that previous assurances regarding such passports were no longer valid. London has offered almost 3 million Hong Kong residents a path to full citizenship after Beijing imposed a controversial national security law on the former British colony. In May, Beijing said that all BNO passport holders were Chinese nationals. Here's our China correspondent, Stephen MacDonald.
Relations between Beijing and London appear to be deteriorating even further over the future of Hong Kong. Yesterday, the British government released more details of its plan to offer a path to citizenship for British national overseas passport holders, and the Chinese government has accused it again of meddling in the country's internal affairs. However, at a regular media briefing, Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin went further. He said that because the UK government has broken its promises on the issue, China was now considering not recognising BNO passports as legitimate travel documents. Many people in Hong Kong have several passports and would be able to leave either way. However, if Beijing goes ahead with this ban, those with only a BNO passport could find it difficult to travel internationally. BNO passports were issued to citizens of Hong Kong living there prior to the 1997 handover. In a statement, the city's British Consulate General said that the new immigration route for BNO citizens to move to the UK was made following the Chinese government's decision to impose a new national security law. It's estimated that nearly 3 million Hong Kong residents could be eligible for UK citizenship under the new scheme.
Stephen MacDonald in Beijing. The European Union's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, has said the prospect of reaching a trade agreement with the UK by the end of the year is now unlikely. The latest round of talks ended in London with both sides saying that there had been progress, but considerable gaps remained, especially around fishing rights and post-Brexit competition rules known as the level playing field. Here's our assistant political editor, Norman Smith.
There is in all such negotiations an element of public bluff and posturing, but the Brexit trade talks do now appear to be in serious jeopardy. After a month of intensive meetings designed to find a breakthrough, not only do both sides appear as far apart as ever, but the mounting exasperation in both camps is clear to see. Indeed, the EU's chief negotiator, Monsieur Barnier, said the UK was no longer engaged and ready to find solutions and had reneged on previous commitments. On the details, he cited in particular the UK's stance on fishing rights, which he said would lead to the partial destruction of the EU's fishing fleet, state aid, where he said there had been no progress, and the continuing refusal of the UK to comply with single market regulations. It was like, he said, asking the EU to foot the bill for Brexit.
By its current refusal to commit the condition of open and fair competition and to a balanced agreement on fishery, the UK makes a trade agreement at this point unlikely.
The UK's chief negotiator, David Frost, while not as pessimistic, nevertheless expressed his annoyance at the EU's unwillingness to give the UK the same sort of trade deal as that offered to Canada. "We remain unclear," he said, "why this is so difficult for the EU." Mr. Frost said he hoped an agreement could still be reached in September, but warned that would not happen unless there was a change in the EU's approach.
It is clear that until the EU has internalised and accepts it, that we will be an independent state with the right to determine our own laws, control our own fishing grounds, then it will be difficult to reach an agreement.
Both sides say a draft deal will need to be reached by October if an agreement is to be in place by the end of the year when the transition period expires. Experience suggests negotiations with the EU do frequently go down to the wire, and these trade talks may be no different. However, it's clear both sides are now bracing themselves for an outcome they both publicly still insist they want to avoid, namely, no deal.
Norman Smith. Scientists have found extinct strains of smallpox in the teeth of Viking skeletons. The study published in the journal Science says the finding indicates that the disease was widespread in northern Europe during the 7th century, almost 1,000 years earlier than thought. And it may well have a bearing on modern diseases, such as the coronavirus. Terry Egan reports.
Smallpox used to be one of the most virulent of human diseases, killing more than 300 million people in the 20th century alone. While its origin remains a mystery, it's believed the virus which caused it may have been transmitted to humans from rodents thousands of years ago. In 1980, it became the first human disease to be eradicated, but scientists say it could re-emerge with the possibility of another strain spilling over from animals. It's why scientists are so keen to find out more about it. Now they've found extinct strains of the virus in the skeletons of humans at 11 burial sites from the Viking era in Denmark, Norway, Russia and the UK. One author of the study, Professor Martin Sikora at the University of Copenhagen, said it means that smallpox was around at least 1,000 years earlier than had been thought. More importantly, though, analysis showed the genetic structure of the ancient strains to be remarkably different from the modern version. And that, he says, suggests the virus may have evolved.
We can really trace back when and where did certain genetic changes happen, how have these viruses adapted to the human host, how have they changed over time to become more serious or maybe also less serious, depending on the virus, of course. So we can really reconstruct the evolutionary trajectory of those viruses over time and get a complete picture of what was once out there in terms of virus diversity and what might actually still be around and related to some of those ancient strains that we see.
Vikings moved extensively around Europe and by some accounts even made it to America. So it's more than likely they were spreading at least one version of smallpox too. Now scientists will be able to study more closely the evolution of the disease. Knowing more about how such viruses develop, they say, could help in the battle against current and emerging infectious diseases.
Terry Egan. Today was supposed to have been the opening ceremony for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, but the coronavirus pandemic has put paid to all of that, and it's now scheduled to take place next year. Japan marked 1 year to go until the postponed games with a low-key ceremony at an almost empty national stadium, as the number of new virus cases in the Japanese capital hit a fresh daily high. It's been a big blow for an Olympic movement, which was already having its challenges even before COVID-19 struck. Ivana Davidovich reports.
The Olympic torch, carried by a young man born in Hiroshima on the day of the atom bomb.
This was Tokyo, celebrating the start of the 1968 Olympic Games. This week, the Olympic Stadium there was scheduled to welcome athletes from all over the world in a lavish opening ceremony in front of adoring spectators. Instead, the organizers released this.
We may not be the same, but 1 year from now, our connection will feel more powerful than ever. After all, it's our differences that give us strength.
A commemorative message marking 365 days until the games are actually supposed to start. And even that has a big question mark hanging over it because of the coronavirus pandemic. Tokyo Today is all about looking ahead and the message of hope echoed by the president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach.
It can and will be the great comeback festival of sport to the international scene. Great festival of hope, of resilience and of solidarity.
While Tokyo 2020 is putting on a brave face despite huge adversity, so are the athletes who were preparing for their big moment.
My name is Marty McBean. I am a three-time Olympic rowing champion and currently I'm the chef de mission of Team Canada for the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo. It's a bit of a flip-flop because there's moments where it's quite melancholy. I had moments where I knew my flight left last week and I know that I should be welcoming hundreds of Canadian athletes to the Olympic Village.
That was Marnie McBean. While Tokyo 2020's future is uncertain because of the global pandemic, in reality, the Olympic Games have been in trouble for a long time, particularly among prospective hosts scared of enormous debt that seems to come with the territory.
Tokyo is predicted to lose $25 billion, and then there are doubts over ticket sales and the revenue from sponsors. But Tokyo is by no means unique. In fact, only one Olympics ever has made a profit for the hosts. Professor Andrew Zimbalist is the author of Circus Maximus, the economic gamble behind hosting the Olympics and the World Cup.
If you do a true accounting that includes really all of the expenses related to hosting the games and compare it to the revenues, then the 1984 games in Los Angeles stand out as being probably the only games that have a true surplus. Previous 15 years of Olympic experience prior to the Los Angeles Games had been pretty much an economic and political bust for the host cities. Going back to Mexico in 68 and Munich in 72 and Montreal in 76, all of those had a variety of fairly egregious problems. So when it came time to bid on Los Angeles, Los Angeles was the only effective bidder. And so Los Angeles had some bargaining leverage that other cities did not have.
But the Olympic Party eventually started to turn sour as the opposition voices grew louder. Even in places which won the bid to host the Games, citizens often struggled to get in the spirit of things. These protesters in Tokyo clearly showing their displeasure. The Olympics found themselves in danger of becoming homeless. There were 11 different cities between 2011 and 2014 who had been interested in hosting, but pulled out because of local opposition.
That report by Ivana Davidovich. A cigarette case given to a speech therapist by the British King George VI was sold for almost $100,000 at an auction in Salisbury in southern England. The lot, which also included a letter written by the monarch to Lionel Logue, is believed to have attracted increased interest because of its connection to a Hollywood blockbuster. Our correspondent Duncan Kennedy has more.
Feel the looseness of the jaw.
A scene from the 2010 Oscar-winning film The King's Speech. It's the true story of King George VI, played by Colin Firth, who tries to overcome his chronic stammer by turning to Lionel Logue, an unconventional, self-taught speech therapist, played by Geoffrey Rush.
Dragon Jill. Went up the hill.
The two men first met in 1926, but it was after the abdication crisis in 1936 that the then Prince Albert would face his sternest test.
Lowers it on the royal brow. The king is crowned.
A coronation and a subsequent live broadcast to the nation.
It is with a very full heart.
In the end, the newly crowned King George did well and wrote to Logue to thank him. He said, "Not a moment's hesitation or mistake. I truly don't know how I could have done it without you."
The Royal Presentation Cigarette Case.
Today in Salisbury, the letter and an accompanying cigarette case were auctioned off.
Are we all done? At £61,000.
After auction fees, the total was £76,000. A sum that might have left Lionel Logue and King George speechless.
That report by Duncan Kennedy. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham. Until next time, goodbye.